Board's first meeting. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
How is the recession affecting your community? WILL and its community partners are hosting a series of public conversations on the economy. Join us in Decatur this evening and in Danville or Rantoul on Thursday, July 23rd. Each event begins at 7 p.m. For location information, visit willconnect.org/economy or call 217-333-7300. That's 333-7300. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. You'll also find us at FM 90.9 HD2 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Depression is an illness that can be debilitating. It affects millions of people in the U.S. each year. Sales of antidepressant drugs exceed $20 billion annually in this country. Our guest this afternoon is psychologist Stephen Ilardi, an associate professor of clinical psychology at the University of Kansas. He encourages patients to make lifestyle changes in order to reduce or eliminate depression. Why lifestyle changes? Ilardi says our contemporary lifestyle has drifted way off course. In his words, human beings were never designed for the poorly nourished, sedentary, indoor, sleep-deprived, socially isolated, frenzied pace of 21st century life. Drawn from the results of published research on depression, he and some of his graduate students began developing a program of lifestyle change a few years ago. He calls it Therapeutic Lifestyle Change, or TLC. Ilardi says the program, which includes a diet rich in omega-3 fatty acids, exercise, techniques and activities to keep us from dwelling on negative thoughts, social supports, and healthy sleep habits, may allow people with depression to reduce or eliminate the need for antidepressants and other treatments. It might also help fend off depression. Stephen Ilardi spells out his ideas in the new book, The Depression Cure, the 6-step program to beat depression without drugs. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited for our guest this afternoon. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. The Depression Cure, the 6-step program to beat depression without drugs, is published by the DeCapo Press. Again, the numbers 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Dr. Ilardi, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure to speak with you. Maybe we should begin with some basics. Like, for example, when we talk about depression, what are we talking about? What is it?
That's a great way to start because, you know, unfortunately, Celeste, I really have come to believe that the word depression is probably the single most widely and tragically misunderstood term that we have in the entire clinical realm. And the problem is the word has two different meanings. Just in everyday conversation, people talk about being depressed just as a way of essentially describing sad mood. In other words, people will say, hey, I'm depressed that my team didn't win last night. I'm depressed that I missed out on that great sale, my TV show didn't tape. The problem is that when we clinicians use the word depression, now we're using it as a shorthand for major depressive illness. In other words, a debilitating condition that robs people of their energy, their healthful sleep, their concentration, their memory, their ability to experience pleasure. It actually robs so many sufferers even of their very will to live, and actually accounts for nearly 1 million deaths due to suicide every year. So there's extraordinary misunderstanding around this term depression.
Yeah. I have known people who have suffered with depression, and a couple of them, it was so severe that it required hospitalization and antidepressant medication. And then I've known a couple of other folks who have managed to hold it together somehow and, in essence, keep it under wraps. Is there a spectrum of depression?
Absolutely. So, in other words, once we resolve that when we're talking about depression now, we're not discussing the way the term is used in everyday conversation. In other words, we're not just talking about sad mood, because sad mood is part of the human condition. Sad mood is essentially 100%, I mean, it's pervasive in the population. It's a normal reaction to disappointments and setbacks. But when we're talking about clinical depression, by definition now we're talking about something that's debilitating. By definition, we're talking about an illness that lights up the brain's pain center. So it's agonizing and it's excruciating. And yet, just as you suggest, there is a continuum. So we can place every single person suffering from depressive illness on some sort of continuum of severity. And at the very far end, as you note, the severity can be so great that it can actually lead to complete incapacitation. We see a set of symptoms that we clinicians refer to as neurovegetative, where the person can be so immobilized that literally they are virtually unable to move. I mean, they have very long response latencies when talking, and you know, very often just being able to get out of bed would be a Herculean effort. Now, fortunately, that's a very, very small subset of all the folks that are suffering from depressive illness. Now, when I say all the folks, we're talking about 70 to 80 million Americans that will suffer some form of depressive illness by the time they reach age 75. That's the latest epidemiological figure. So we're talking about an epidemic. The majority of folks that will be diagnosed with depressive illness will be in the mild to moderate end of the spectrum. So in other words, they'll be in great pain. They may lose their will to live. They'll certainly lose some of their ability to function. But like you suggest, they may retain at least some of that ability as well.
Now, your program, the Therapeutic Lifestyle Change Program, is it something to be used in place of treatment or in combination with treatment?
You know, actually, it can be either. And I've been very, very adamant about this point from the outset. You know, a lot of times when people hear about the idea of treating depression with lifestyle change, they think, oh, you know, this is either some sort of wacky fringe idea, or maybe this is coming from someone who's philosophically anti-medication, and nothing could be further from the truth. I'm not anti-medication, I'm anti-depression, and, you know, I'm certainly a believer in fighting it with everything that we have at our disposal. Part of the problem, however, Celeste, is that the medications, unfortunately, haven't fully lived up to the hype that surrounded them. As you know, there are hundreds of millions of dollars that have been spent promoting psychotropic medications, but if we actually take a deep, hard, careful, objective look at the published research data on the effectiveness, on the efficacy of antidepressant medications, we come away with not such an optimistic picture. And if I could boil it down just in a nutshell for you, what we find is in the short term, of all the patients, depressed individuals who begin taking an antidepressant medication, the proportion over the first 2 to 3 months who will go into complete remission is somewhere around 30%. In the largest ever real-world trial that was just published 2 years ago, that figure was 28% of all those out of over 4,000 patients who began standard antidepressant therapy. Fewer than one in two, it was 47%, fewer than one in two experienced any clinically significant improvement. And the data actually get worse as we look long-term, because the majority of patients who begin antidepressant medication therapy don't stay on it for longer than about 3 months. And unfortunately, once they go off, the risk of recurrence, the risk of depression coming back, goes up very, very rapidly. And in fact, within 6 months after discontinuing an antidepressant medication, half of all patients tend to experience another episode. So it's not a terribly rosy long-term picture. We clearly don't have a a widespread cure with antidepressant medications, and that's why I believe we need to do better. And it, luckily, it turns out that there are so many things that we can do in changing our life that can reduce both the acute symptoms of depression and reduce long-term risk as well.
Mm. Has there been a scientific trial or trials of the program you call therapeutic lifestyle change?
Absolutely. In fact, we have a trial ongoing. For the past 4 years, we've recruited about 110 patients into our clinical study. And the results have really been remarkable. And I have to be a little bit careful in talking about them because even though they've been presented at our national conferences, they've been presented at American Psychological Association, at the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapy. They haven't been peer-reviewed and published in a professional journal. But what I can tell you is out of the roughly 110 patients that we've randomized to receive either therapeutic lifestyle change or treatment as usual in the community, and that's typically medication, sometimes concurrently with traditional psychotherapy, here are the basically the response rates that we've seen. In treatment as usual, it's been right around 27% of patients over 3 months that have had what we term a favorable treatment response, and that simply means they've had at least a 50% reduction in symptoms, and they no longer meet full diagnostic criteria for depressive illness. So 27%, that's the benchmark. In our therapeutic lifestyle change condition, that response rate has been 74%. So roughly three times higher, which has been enormously encouraging. The thing that makes it even more encouraging is that the vast majority of folks that have come into us, into this treatment study, have already failed at some point on traditional medication. So as I was saying, there's a large subset of patients who tried the antidepressant medications who don't achieve the sort of relief that they were looking for, who may find the side effects onerous and difficult and burdensome to tolerate, and you know, who want to look at some other treatment possibility.
Yeah. There's a line in a song, and I can't remember the song title now, but the line goes, "We get better, but we never get well." Mm. How was better or cured defined, or how is it being defined, better and cured, wellness? How are you working on those concepts?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really insightful question. You know, a lot of times I will talk to patients because I get this question all the time. And very often, the first time a person experiences an episode of depression, they so want to believe that this is a one-time, flukish sort of anomaly. It's like, oh my God, this thing took me over. I wasn't myself. I couldn't function. I had such a bleak outlook. I was in such pain. I withdrew from all the people around me. Thank God it's over. I've recovered. And I never have to think about it again. And what I have to tell my patients is if you look at the best long-term studies that we have of long-term outcomes in depression, what you find is that the overwhelming majority will become depressed again at some point. Now, I don't leave it there because that sounds like a very, very bleak and almost a cruel thing for a clinician to say. 85 to 90% of depressed individuals will become depressed again. But what I tell them is let's use that for motivation, because there are so many things that we can do to help you cut that risk down to not only far below 50%, but to minimize that risk. So we need to think of depression from the standpoint of vulnerability as a lifelong illness. In other words, once a person has been depressed, there's a dramatically higher probability that they'll become depressed again. On the other hand, the good news is, if they are willing to begin changing their life, there are so many ways of reducing that risk. And that's why I'm so excited about the idea of lifestyle change. And the basic premise underlying the whole thing, and we haven't really talked about this yet, is that we were never really designed for the 21st century life that we're living. And thank goodness there are healing habits of the past that we can reclaim. In other words, you know, we as a species, historically, and by historically I mean looking back over the span of evolutionary time, we as a species have never been as frail and as vulnerable to depressive illness as we are now, and it's a good thing, because if our, let's say, hunter-gatherer ancestors had been as inclined to depressive illness as we are, it's quite likely we never would have made it as a species. because their lives are much harder than ours, and yet they seem so much more resilient. At least that's what we know based on the best anthropological data that we have.
Yeah. You know, though, we live longer, we have lots of stuff.
Yeah, we do.
That our ancestors could not have even dreamed of having.
So we should be the happiest people, the least depression prone who've ever lived.
So what's going on?
Well, I think what's going on is a kind of a perverse and ironic mismatch. As you said, by so many different metrics, we should be so happy. And yet, if we look at the sort of world that our bodies, that our brains, and more importantly, that our genes are expecting to see, it's a world that's radically different from the one that we inhabit. And, it's interesting because medical anthropologists have discovered a whole set of what we could, I think, for want of a better term, call diseases of modernity. In other words, diseases that tend to characterize affluent, industrialized, urbanized Western populations, but diseases that, in fact, are almost completely absent among folks who are living a much more traditional sort of lifestyle. And, we could make a long list of these sorts of diseases of modernity. Obesity comes quickly to mind, as does diabetes, as does metabolic syndrome, and then as does depression, interestingly enough, because as we look across the face of the planet right now, what we find, more or less, the more industrialized, the more urbanized, the more westernized, the more modernized a particular society, the higher their rate of depressive illness.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, psychologist Stephen Ilardi. He's an associate professor of clinical psychology at the University of Kansas, where he has developed what he calls therapeutic lifestyle change. And he spells this program out in his book, The Depression Cure, The Six-Step Program to Beat Depression Without Drugs. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, what are the six elements of your program that can help protect us from depression?
Celeste, would you like me just to list them quickly, or would you like a little explanatory note with these?
Let's list them quickly, and then we can pick them apart.
Okay. Well, here we go. So we'll start with intense physical exercise. So physical activity. Second, diet, and in particular, omega-3 fatty acids, which are key building blocks of brain tissue. Third, sunlight exposure. Fourth, ample and abundant healthy sleep. Fifth, social connectedness and community. And sixth, engaging activity that leaves little time for rumination or dwelling on negative thoughts.
Okay. Now, a number of these things, they make perfect sense right off the bat when we think about it.
They really do, don't they?
Yeah.
And I get people that tell me all the time, they'll say, Dr. Ilardi, these are things that my grandmother told me I should be doing, these are things that my parents tell me I should be doing. They make perfect sense. They resonate on such an intuitive level, but can they really be powerful enough to tackle my depression? After all, isn't depression a quote-unquote chemical imbalance? And if I have a chemical imbalance, then don't I need medication? It's a very common question. I think it's a compelling question, and it's unfortunately, I think it's predicated on a bit of a logical non sequitur. And what I mean by that is, yes, absolutely, let's affirm something that's clear beyond any doubt, and that is depressive illness does involve an array of different neurochemical anomalies. In other words, chemical imbalance, it's a kind of a crude metaphor, but yes, absolutely. There are neurochemical abnormalities in depression beyond a shadow of a doubt. There are dozens of them. And yet, this tells us next to nothing about the optimal way of intervening. And the reason for that is the fact that experience changes the brain. What we do changes the brain. What we think changes the brain. What we eat changes the brain. It's now known beyond the shadow of a doubt that exercise is one of the most potent means of changing neurochemistry ever discovered. It changes activity in neural circuits that use dopamine, that use serotonin. It increases activity of a neural growth hormone called BDNF that actually plummets in depression, and that over time, this loss of BDNF leads to the death of neurons in the brain's memory and reasoning centers. So depression can be neurotoxic, and yet exercise helps turn that around in a very powerful way. So chemical imbalance tells us really very little about the best way of addressing depression. And when people fully grasp that, I think it's a very empowering idea, because now it says, hey, you know what? The things that your grandmother told you are useful for you are also things that can change your brain chemistry.
Yeah. I was pleased in your book, The Depression Cure, that you said one of the reasons maybe we don't do what's good for us is the way we think about it. And exercise is one of those words.
Absolutely.
And
it's a treacherous word, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I think you hit it right on the head when you say, you know, what we should be doing is we should be thinking about pleasurable activities.
Exactly. Yeah, and meaningful activities, you know, because, you know, I'm a firm believer that if we really take seriously this idea of our evolutionary heritage, the idea that our ancestors really spent 99.9% of their existence as hunter-gatherers, they could not afford the luxury of exercise. And so far as we know from the anthropological record, no hunter-gatherers that have ever been studied, ever been encountered, exercise. They would consider it insane. What they do is they go about their business living their lives, and they follow a very simple rule, which is only expend energy on activities that have a very clear purpose. Now, that purpose might be recreational, but it's a purpose nonetheless. And so, you know, when we stare at a piece of exercise equipment in our basement or in the gym or wherever it happens to be, there's a little part of our brain that's yelling out. As we're looking at that treadmill, there's a little part of our brain that's yelling out and saying, don't get on that thing. Don't do it. You're not going anywhere on that. It doesn't serve a purpose. And so I think once we fully make our peace with the idea that exercise is unnatural, then we can harness the sort of built-in biases of the human brain to make physical activity something that we can actually enjoy and make our peace with. But we just have to be a little bit clever about it.
Yeah. Diet's another one of those words.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, maybe we should think about good food. A diet rich in omega-3 fatty acids, that's something that you call for in this book. Why,
absolutely.
Why omega-3 fatty acids, and what are they?
Yeah, well, you know, they've been getting a lot of airplay lately, right, in the popular press and in the mainstream media. But for folks who don't know about omega-3s, they're one of two types of fats that our body doesn't know how to make. They can only come from our diet, and so we're critically dependent on our diet for making sure that we have enough. Now, why is it important to have enough? Because omega-3s turn out to be key building blocks of brain tissue. The brain is roughly 60% fat. I think that kind of surprises people. Your brain is mostly made up of fat, and the most essential, the most crucial type of fat, omega-3s, is one that your body doesn't know how to make. So if you're not getting enough of it from your diet, you're in big trouble. And it gets even worse because omega-3s are also building blocks for hormones in the body that are anti-inflammatory. And so if we don't have enough omega-3s, we typically wind up with chronic systemic inflammation. And it turns out that the depressed brain is also an inflamed brain. So omega-3s have a couple of very important antidepressant properties. And here's the biggest problem. The average American gets about 1/16 as much omega-3, in other words, about 6% as much omega-3s in their diet as they need for optimal brain health. And not surprisingly, there's a very strong correlation between circulating blood levels of omega-3s and vulnerability to depression. And we see it among Americans, and then we see it nationally as we look at national depression data across the world. So omega-3s play a very, very big role in protecting us from depression.
Yeah. You say in The Depression Cure that people who become depressed have lower omega-3 blood levels than those who don't.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's a really startling finding. You know, if you look at the ratio of omega-3s to the other type of dietary fat that we get, omega-6s. And omega-6s, just in a nutshell, those are fats that we get from vegetable oils. They're fats that we get from our meat supply, because pretty much all of the animals that we eat are grain-fed, they're corn-fed, and corn is a great source of omega-6s. Well, omega-6s are pro-inflammatory. They promote inflammation, and we need them, but we just need a little of them. And we need about a one-to-one balance in our diet of omega-6 and omega-3. The typical American, if you look at their blood levels, the omega-6 outweighs omega-3 by 16 to 1. If you look in depression, it's over 20 to 1, and we need roughly 1 to 1 for optimal brain health. And so as it turns out, we need some pretty drastic measures to get things back into balance. And fortunately, there's a very simple and elegant solution. It's not the most natural solution, okay, but it's the most pragmatic, and that is simply to begin taking a high-dose fish oil supplement, because fish oil, at least as packaged in most of our supplements, fish oil turns out to be a really rich, dense source of omega-3 fats.
Yeah. What about foods that we might eat? What are some rich sources of omega-3 in foods?
Well, that's a great question. The best sources, just as fish oil is a great supplement, cold water fish also generally tend to be very rich in omega-3s. There's a little bit of a caveat that we have to throw out in that, though, because it requires about 2 servings a day to get an antidepressant dose of omega-3s. So in other words, if a person is currently depressed, they're going to need about 1,000 milligrams a day of an omega-3 fat called EPA. And I know this is kind of technical, and I go through all the details in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But there are 3 different types of omega-3s, and the one that's proven to be most antidepressant, the one that happens to be the most anti-inflammatory, is called EPA. And we need about 1,000 milligrams, well, actually 1 to 2,000 milligrams a day of that. To get that through diet would require about 2 servings a day of cold water fish. So that could be salmon, it could be tuna, it could be mackerel, it could be sardines, anchovies. The problem is that sadly, much of our cold water fish supply, because most of them feed way up at the top of the food chain, they're prone to collecting in their tissues mercury and lead and PCBs and other toxins. And so there's a non-trivial risk of accumulating over a lifetime pretty high levels of these sorts of things that we don't want. So the nice advantage of taking a good fish oil product as a supplement is that it's been molecularly distilled. So the vast majority of the toxins have been taken out. And so I like to recommend that for patients, at least in the short term, A, because it only takes them about 30 seconds a day, so it's not asking someone who's depressed to make a radical overhaul of their diet. And then the second thing is, in the long term, it's helping ensure that they don't face any sort of risk of mercury toxicity from eating too much cold water fish over a long period of time.
Yeah. Reading the label on a supplement, let me back up. I want to ask this question first. Are there contraindications for omega-3 supplementation?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yeah, as it turns out, there are. I mean, there aren't many. But if a person has a fish allergy, which is not a whole lot of folks, but that would be an issue.
Mm.
The bigger issue is, and this is beneficial for most people, omega-3s at reasonably high doses have a very nice antiplatelet property. And I say very nice because it tends to strongly reduce the risk of certain types of heart disease. For most Americans who are at risk for heart disease, the anti-inflammatory and anticoagulant properties or antiplatelet properties of omega-3s are very beneficial. The problem is if somebody already has some sort of a clotting disorder, a bleeding disorder, if they're taking a blood-thinning medication like heparin or warfarin or Coumadin, then yes, they would definitely need to talk to their doctor before even considering taking an omega-3 supplement.
Yeah, and at the outset of your book, you urge people, and pretty strongly, people who read the book, to talk with their physicians prior to embarking on the program.
Absolutely. I think that's essential. I really do. So, it's kind of ironic in a way, right? Because, I mean, here this is a self-help book that says, hey, you know what? You can change your brain by changing your life. And by the way, each of these lifestyle elements, each of these 6 elements, has already been tested head-to-head against antidepressant medication and found to be powerfully effective. So these are not just little Band-Aid sorts of strategies that we're recommending. And yet I also say, in essence, if I can paraphrase, hey, don't try this at home. Don't try this at home until you've spoken to a physician, because anytime you're going to be making major changes in your level of physical activity, major changes in your diet, major changes in your level of sunlight exposure, These are things that have medical implications. Now, in the vast majority of cases, your doc is going to pat you on the back and say, God bless you, you're making some of the most healthful, some of the most important changes you could possibly make. But just to be on the safe side, it's always a good thing. The other thing I want to mention really quickly about seeing a doctor is antidepressant medications. You know, I have to be really careful because the title of the book says, this is a program, in at least in principle, to beat depression without drugs. In our clinical trials so far, we've seen every bit as much benefit for patients who've done the TLC protocol that have been on antidepressant medications as those who have been not on antidepressant medication. Now, I say that, and yet I don't want someone to begin putting this program into place and say, oh, therefore I'm going to throw my bottle of Zoloft down the toilet, right? I'm going to just jettison that Celexa and that Lexapro. That's a very, very dangerous thing because antidepressant medication, this is not widely known, but antidepressant medications, generally speaking, can have an extraordinarily difficult, painful withdrawal syndrome. And it's much more difficult and much more painful if somebody stops taking their antidepressants cold turkey. If they just stop taking them, this can be a very difficult syndrome. It can last for 2 to 3 weeks, and unfortunately, it can also mimic many of the very symptoms of depression itself. Now, this was not something that was widely advertised. It's not something that you tend to see popping up in the middle of a Zoloft commercial on TV. And yet, you know, I would feel horrible if any listener, if any reader somehow walked away with the impression that, oh, I can just throw my meds in the garbage can because I'm making these changes, I'm exercising, I'm getting abundant sunlight and so forth.
Yeah. So again, let's emphasize that this program can help people with depression to reduce or eliminate the need for antidepressants and other treatments, may allow people, and it also might help fend off depression. And it's something to look into, and it's something definitely you want to talk with your doc about. Let's take some calls now. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Ilardi. He's a psychologist, and he's the author of The Depression Cure, the 6-Step Program to Beat Depression Without Drugs. The program includes some of these elements: a diet rich in omega-3 fatty acids, exercise, techniques and activities that keep us from dwelling on negative thoughts, social supports, healthy sleep habits, and there's one more, I think, that I left out. Sunlight.
Yeah, which is critical.
Okay. So now let's go to the phones. Let's take a couple of calls here. A listener in Urbana. Line one, hello.
Hi, is that me?
That's you.
Okay. When I called, I could not find this information, but on my fish oil bottle. Okay, I've been taking fish oil for a while. This fish oil says 1,200 milligrams, and then I was looking to see about the EPA, and finally I found that it's here's what it says: fish oil concentrate 2,400 milligrams. Then beneath that it indented omega-3 fatty acids in parentheses EPA, DHA, and other. Omega-3, 720 milligrams.
And does it break it down further?
It does not. It does
not. Oh. Well, that's not good.
Would it be typical for the supplement to...
Yes, to break it down. Yes, the majority of supplements that I've seen, I would say the great majority, break it down further and will tell you the specific concentration of EPA and then DHA, which is the longest omega-3 molecule that also has some antidepressant properties, is usually broken out separately. Now, the other thing that you want to be careful about is you mentioned 2,400 milligrams total. That sounds to me like they may be giving a serving size of 2 capsules.
Oh, yeah, they are, actually.
Okay, so then you'd have to even subdivide that further per capsule. The typical drugstore brand...
Yeah, that's what this is.
The drugstore, the typical drugstore brand fish oil product has about 180 milligrams of EPA per capsule. So if you do the math on that, if you're targeting a dose of 1,000 a day, you would need approximately 6 capsules per day to get that antidepressant dose. That's the dose that's been best supported by the research. That's a dose that seems to be roughly equivalent to antidepressant medications in its efficacy. But if
I see. Oh, that's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why some folks actually, and I'm going to put myself in this category, I like to take a liquid instead because I don't want to be swallowing 6 pills a day. I take it just, you know, 1 teaspoon of a supplement, and then I chase it with typically grapefruit juice or orange juice, which really masks the taste nicely, and then I run for my toothbrush. You know, now my wife and daughter both have decided no, they'd rather have the capsules than have any sort of fish taste on their breath at all. But either way is, you know, perfectly fine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the question.
Next, we take another call from a listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hi, I have 2 questions.
Okay.
The first is, if the brain is 60% fat, how does a low-fat diet affect the brain? And the second is, if you don't take fish oil or you can't take fish oil, how does flaxseed oil compare?
Those are great questions. Can I take the second one first and
sure.
then back in?
Sure.
Okay. Flaxseed oil is a phenomenal source of the shortest of the 3 omega-3 molecules. It's called ALA. The problem is that in the body, ALA is not very efficiently converted into the EPA and DHA, the longer forms that we need. In fact, the best studies that I've seen suggest that at most 5-7% will get converted, but in most people, it's going to be only around 1-2%. What that means is, in essence, that flaxseed oil is not going to give us nearly enough EPA to be effective as an antidepressant. Although it certainly can be helpful, it does have anti-inflammatory properties, but there's no really compelling research to support its use in the treatment of depression. Now, let's see. The second question is, what about the effects of a low-fat diet on the brain? You know, it depends on what we regard as a low-fat diet. The typical American diet is about 35% fat, and so this is really, by world historical standards, an insanely high-fat diet. For us, we think of 10% of calories coming from fat as low-fat, and yet that's about the standard Chinese diet. And all the evidence suggests that their neurological health, if anything, is better than ours. And so, you know, when you get into sort of radically cutting fat way down below that, yes, that could have an adverse effect on the brain. But for most Americans, I really wouldn't be too concerned about it, as long as there are ample omega-3s as part of that equation.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call, and let's take another call. Listener in Charleston, line 3, hi.
Hi, thank you.
Go ahead.
My question is, as we give these drug treatments to younger and younger populations, like even in the developmental age, is it possible, or have you seen anything in the research, or do you have any indications from your experience that would suggest that these treatments at a young age might actually change the biochemistry of the brain permanently so that it would maybe even preclude some of the treatments like that you're trying to do with the TLC?
You know, that's a fascinating question, and I'm sorry to say that we really don't have the necessary evidence to weigh in on that one way or the other. As a parent, I can tell you, as a parent of a 12-year-old, I can tell you that if my daughter were battling depressive illness, I would try every option available prior to even considering antidepressant medication. Now, I'm not judging parents who reach for the prescription pad as the very first option, but what I'm saying is we absolutely know, based on an FDA black box warning on antidepressants, that there is a non-trivial increase in the risk of suicidality for anyone below the age of 25 taking an antidepressant medication. You may have heard about this. I think probably most listeners saw this a couple years ago. The risk went from 2% of all those in the FDA database taking an antidepressant, 2% who had suicidal thoughts or behaviors on a placebo, on a sugar pill, the risk doubled to 4% among those who were taking an antidepressant. I can tell you, I think almost any parent, if their child had a severe infection and the doc, you know, handed them an antibiotic and said, hey, this antibiotic has about a 50% chance of clearing up the infection, but there's a 4% chance that your child will become suicidal, I think most parents would take a pass on that one unless they had exhausted every other possibility. And the one you suggest, which is that we really don't know one way or the other whether or not using antidepressant meds while the brain is still developing, and by the way, the brain continues developing and maturing up to about age 23 to 25, we just don't know what effect that would have. And as a parent, I would urge caution.
Listener, want to follow up?
If I could, please.
Certainly.
Do the guidelines for administering the drug treatments, are they different for younger kids, or is it the same, like DSM criteria to establish, you know, the diagnosis and then the drug treatment? Is it the discretion of the clinician, or are the guidelines different? Does my question make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, and you know, it's kind of an interesting irony. Last time I checked, there was only one antidepressant medication that had FDA approval and recommendation in treatment for children, and that was, interestingly enough, Prozac. When physicians are using other medications for the treatment of depression in children, they're typically doing so off-label. In other words, it's at their discretion, but it's not something that the FDA has explicitly put their imprimatur on and said this is something we recommend or necessarily even want to advocate. It's up to the discretion of the physician. Now, you know, let's just say that the current zeitgeist, the current thinking in the area is depression is a chemical imbalance, therefore you must ingest chemicals. If kids get depressed, they have a chemical imbalance, let's feed them chemicals. And what I'm trying to say to folks is, look, I'm not going to judge that approach, but I'm going to say instead, this is based on a logical fallacy. We can change the brain by changing people's lives. We have abundant neuroscientific, neuroimaging evidence to show that exercise, you know, if the neurological effects of exercise could be captured in a pill, it would skyrocket up the charts and it would become the number one best-selling medication of all time in a very short span of time. Hmm. Let's try that first. That's what I would say to parents.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. So it's really important to get the kids outside in the sunshine and get them playing.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned sunshine, too, because, you know, one other thing that's been getting a lot of media attention of late is the fact that most Americans are woefully deficient in vitamin D. And it turns out that vitamin D isn't really even a proper vitamin at all. It's a critical hormone. It's something that we need. It actually works like a little chemical key that unlocks over 1,000 different genes in the body and allows them to function. Well, most of those genes that vitamin D works on are in the brain. So if we're vitamin D deficient, as about 80% of Americans are, 80% of Americans deficient in this key regulatory molecule that helps our brain function, it's going to have big implications. And we now know that vitamin D deficiency is a large risk factor for the onset of depression. Well, vitamin D is synthesized in our skin when it's exposed to sunlight. And fortunately, it doesn't take a whole lot of sunlight exposure if we do it the right way to get an ample amount of vitamin D. But it's for most of us, it's going to be about 10 to 15 minutes of sun exposure between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. Between the months of about April and October. During the winter, the sun's rays are not quite strong enough to penetrate deeply enough in the skin to synthesize mm-hmm. vitamin D, and so supplementation might actually be in order.
Okay, so you'd recommend then a multivitamin?
Yes, I would absolutely recommend a multivitamin, and I thank you for mentioning that for two reasons. One is because most of us don't get our recommended 9 servings of fruit and veggies every day, and so we don't have a high enough concentration of antioxidants in our system. Excuse me. The reason that's important is because when we take omega-3s at high doses, omega-3s and oxygen just do not mix well at all. When we have unbound oxygen in our bodies, it can basically neutralize those omega-3s before it has a chance to slot itself into the brain and do its thing. So antioxidants are going to be critical as a companion, as an accompaniment to the omega-3s. And, of course, a multivitamin is full of lots of different antioxidant compounds. But the second reason is the multivitamin has vitamin D. Now, the problem, here's a caveat, a multivitamin only has about 400 IUs, or international units, of vitamin D. And the best research evidence that's been coming out over the last decade suggests that when we're deficient in vitamin D, we probably need a dose that's 5 to 10 times higher than that multivitamin dose to slowly get us back up into a non-deficient range. that's something that we definitely want to consult with our physician about, though, because high-dose vitamin D supplementation carries certain small but non-trivial risks as well.
Yeah, and there's a test for that, too.
There's a wonderful test. Yeah. It's a very simple blood test, and the doc will look for something called 25-OHD, which is kind of a fancy way of saying the supercharged form of vitamin D that does its thing in this anti-inflammatory way in the body. And, you know, it used to be thought that your blood level of this, if anybody actually wants to look at their printout, if they have their blood work and see 25-OHD, it used to be thought, oh, well, once you're at, you know, about 25 or so, you're going to be okay, and 30 and above, you're in great shape. Well, the best evidence that's coming out now says you really, for optimal health, want to be above 50. You want to be above 50 on that, even though your doc will probably just shrug as long as you're over 30. So a strong case, I think, could be made for supplementation until we get very close to that nice 50 threshold.
Yeah. I've got about 1 minute left, and I want you to talk about rumination.
Absolutely. Rumination, you know, it's just a fancy clinical way of saying dwelling on or brooding on negative thoughts. And it's something we all do from time to time, especially as just a natural reaction to some sort of upsetting event. The problem is, in depression, people brood or ruminate or dwell for hours at a time, and it does two things that are very toxic. One is it amplifies the intensity of our negative mood. Two, it ramps up activity in the brain's stress response circuits, and those are responsible for maintaining an episode of depression. So we need to break the rumination habit. How? We start identifying the high-risk situations, which typically involve spending too much time alone, spending time in front of a television, spending time sitting stuck in traffic, and then working in those situations to redirect our attention to something that's more engaging. Typically, that will involve social interaction or some form of engaging activity.
Yeah, I would imagine, though, someone who is experiencing depression, that's a tall order.
It's a tall order. The nice thing is, though, it's something that they can do with just a bit of coaching. I actually had a patient that came in to see me about 4 years ago. She had been putting into place 5 of the 6 therapeutic lifestyle change elements, but she was ruminating all day long, and she couldn't figure out why her depression wasn't completely clearing up. She was getting better, but she couldn't really get completely well. We started targeting rumination. She approached it with incredible dedication. Within 3 weeks, she had begun to learn how to really turn that habit around. It made a profound difference. She was in complete remission. Last time I heard from her, she's been in sustained remission for 4 years, the longest stretch of depression-free living she's ever experienced.
That's great. Very interesting. Stephen Ilardi, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Stephen Ilardi is the author of The Depression Cure, the 6-step program to beat depression without drugs. He is an associate professor of clinical psychology at the University of Kansas. The book, The Depression Cure, is published by the DeCapo Press. It is 1:54. Todd Gleason is standing by with settlement prices from Kansas City and Chicago.
Thanks, Celeste. Taking a look at the numbers as they settled in Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon. Futures like this for the day. A lot of red there. December wheat was down 7.25. Nearby September down 7.5. It had a high price at 544.25, a low at 530.25, and the SEP settled at 534.75. Once again, 7.5 lower. That December contract to $5.70.5 top, bottom at 57.25. Settlement price at $5.61.5, down 7.25 in the March futures. 588.25 the high, the low at 75.75. Settlement price at $5.80. March soft red winter wheat down 7.25 cents in Chicago, in Kansas City, where they trade the hard red, the September lead option at $5.65.75 on its settlement price, finished 5.25 lower. Back in Chicago for the corn pit, September futures 324.5 the high, the low at 310.25, settled 311.5, down 11.75. December 335, the high, the low at 320.5, settlement price at $3.22, down 11.75. And March contract, 348.5, the high, the low at 334.25, settlement price at 335.75, down 11.75. The March futures, 356.25, the high, the low at $3.44, settled 345.5, down 11.75. In July corn futures, 12 cents lower today, $3.67.25, the high, the low at 353.25, settlement price at 354.25, down 12 cents. Oat futures nearby September contract 206.25 down 9.75. From the soy complex nearby August beans, $10.40 the high, the low at 10.05.25. Settlement price at 10.14.5 down 18.5. September 9.66.5 the high, the low at 33.5. Settlement price at $9.41.5 down 19 in November beans. 9.26 the high, the low at $8.95.5, settled $9.05 down 18 cents. January futures 9.32.25 to the high, the low at 9.03.25. Settlement price 9.12.25, down 17.75 for the day. And the March contract 17.75 lower as well at $9.17. November of 2010 at $9.02, down 12. August soybean meal futures had a high of 330.40 today, the low at 317.30. Settlement price at $322.30. Down $2.10 in the August soybean oil at $35.49 on its top. Bottom at $34.50. Settlement price at $34.77. Down 57. I'll return in just about 6.5 minutes, or rather 9 minutes now, I guess, with closing mark report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time, when we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, and get an update on what's been happening in the world of crop production across Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota. Those are the 5 top corn-producing states in the nation. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
August contract, a high price of $86.87.5, a low at $85.80. Settlement price at $86.02.5, $0.77.5 lower. The October live cattle, $91.85 the high, the low at $90.75. Settlement price at $91.12.5, down 75. And December futures, $90.30 the high, the low at $89.27.5. Settlement price, $89.72.5, down 67.5. February futures, $89.72.5, the high, the low at $88.70. Settlement price at $88.92.5, down 87.5. And the August feeders today, $104.20, the high, the low at $103.20. Settlement price at $103.25, down $1.22.5. September feeder cattle, $104.25, the high, the low at $103.20. Settlement price at $103.25, down $1.25. And the October futures, $104.10, the high, low at $103.15. And the settlement price for the October feeder cattle, $103.17.5, down $1.20. November futures, $104 and a nickel, the high, the low at $103.05 for 100 pounds. And a settlement price at $103.12.5, down $1.17.5. August lean hog futures, $63.70, the high, the low at $62.10. Settled $62.50, down $2.15. The October, $59.50, the high, the low at $57.65. Settlement price at $58.15, down $2.32.5. And the December futures, $57.75, the high, low at $56.45. Settlement price $57.45, 90 cents lower. February lean hog futures, $63 and a nickel, the high, the low at $62.10. Settled $62.95, down 80 cents. Frozen pork bellies on the afternoon, down $2.30. And the two nearby contracts, those are the July and August, $62.20. The settlement price in the July, August at $63.50. Both finished $2.30 lower. Back at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon, I'm Todd Gleason.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. The weather forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in Indiana, partly to mostly sunny. In southern and western Illinois, cloudy with showers and occasional thunderstorms. In eastern Illinois, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms. Highs ranging from 72 in western Illinois to 82 in southeastern Indiana. Tonight, north, mostly cloudy with widely scattered showers and possibly a few isolated thunderstorms in southern sections and